Rusty Quill presents.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Hey everybody, this is Tyler Bell and welcome to the West Side Fairy Tales Horror and Lit Club episode for, oh my god, what is it, November already? For November of 2019, of our most recent episode, Best Roses, Manassas, West Virginia, where I will be discussing that episode's recommendations, which are Beloved by Toni Morrison and the film Society, directed by Brian Usna. Before I hop into all that, I'll talk with you guys for a little bit. Ignore the rustling of my notes. Oh man, it just got cold here. It just got cold here today, or not today, last week. And we have been we've been doing everything. I'm so busy right now, and I know I'm going to be even busier next year because season 5 is already going to be a big thing, man. For all you longtime listeners out there, I know season four is the biggest season to date, and I think every season has really just been bigger than the one before it. But I think season 5 is going to be the one that breaks the bank work-wise. It might end, and I'll have to take like a few months to myself just to like reconnoiter after it's done, because I'm pretty sure even right now that it's going to be more than 10 months long, and there's probably going to be more than two episodes, or at least two episodes per month. So look forward to that. In addition to the Horror and Lit Club episodes, which won't stop. So, man, dude, so I've been writing that, and, I'm already 80,000 words in. So there's that. And it's going to end up probably at least 70,000 words in, and it's probably going to end up at around 140,000 total words for the entire season, if not possibly a touch more, or maybe even a touch less. I'm kind of leaning to a touch more, considering how much of the story I've established. And man, I'm really excited for that for you guys. I think you'll like it. I'm excited for the rest of this season still. Like, we have some fucking incredible stories coming. Like, I can actually say that I'm excited about my own stories, just because they're impactful. I think I've really hit my stride as a writer in this last couple years, just because I've been doing so fucking much writing that it's it's really become a part of me. I don't even know how to describe it. It is my job now. It's what I tell people I do when I talk to them. And I don't make that much money. I mean, you know, I'm not Stephen King yet, or even one of his less talented children. But man, I'm really in there. I'm really in there, and I'm really in it. I can't thank you guys enough. I do that every episode, but hey, man. I'm just doing it again. I'm doing it again. And for those of you who don't know what a Horror and Lit Club is, because you're new to the podcast, this isn't one of the regular story episodes. I know some of the stories I lead in, especially the mini-sodes, I give you false lead-ins, and it turns into a story randomly. Don't worry about that with these. These are non-canon. I mean, I don't even really discuss the podcast itself. These are literally discussions of the recommendations and just me kind of chattering and letting you guys get to know me a little bit more as a person. Because I don't like the standoffish artistic types. I don't like the people that shroud themselves in mystery. Well, what do you think? What do you think the deeper meaning is? Because usually they're just full of shit. And if they know if they start talking, the whole illusion will collapse down around them. But I'm just me. I'm just a fucking scumbag blue collar kid from the fucking west side of Cincinnati, now living in the east side of Louisville. Moving on up. I've never not been that, and I never won't be that. So I would rather just be straightforward. I would hate, I think I probably said this on a million things, but I would hate for me to ever get like some semblance of success and for there to be like that moment where people are like, well, what we really want to do is we want to sell you as this kind of person. And I'm like, I just want to be me. So I'm just getting that. I'm taking that opportunity off the table for people and also creating a situation where, you know, I don't want anyone to, I mean, people still might. It's not like everybody listens to the West Side, the Whore and Lit Club, but I don't want there to be a period where people like hear me talk for the first time on like some show or something, and they're like, oh, he's not wise and enigmatic. He's just some sort of foul mouthed fucking sleazeball. And I'll be like, yes, I am. Proud of it. I'm an infantry marine until the day I die. I don't get to walk away from that. I will forever be a machine gunner, for best or for worst. I'm an 0331 for life, dog. Generally that's for worse. No one wants to be a machine gunner. Everyone gets machine guns foisted on them. What did you want to do? I wanted to be a rifleman. I wanted to breach houses. What are you going to do? You're going to carry around 90 pounds of fucking, functionally speaking, obsolete machine gun equipment for the entire time that you're in your training period. And then when you deploy, you're just going to be a rifleman anyway, because we don't do machine gun based enveloped field of fire trench warfare anymore. And no one would, because there's fucking robots that fly around in the sky and drop bombs. So it's a completely esoteric MOS. I'll talk about that for a second. I like going on little diversions, just because I like teaching people about stuff. That's one of the fun things about being a writer is you get to expose people to new concepts and ideas. And I don't think a lot of people know that about writing, that are famous writers right now, which is why their fucking books are garbage. They have nothing. They bring nothing. It's like, What is the entirety of your writing? Like, oh, well, I think I know how to make a kind of an unnerving little situation there. And then blah, 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 blah. I like to talk about myself. And that's not what I like about writing. I like writing where you're like, okay, I read a book, but then also I learned all this shit. That's why I like Assassin's Creed, the Assassin's Creed games. I don't know. I haven't played almost any of the new ones. But Assassin's Creed 2 is one of my favorite games ever, because it helped me pass college ancient history classes, because I just fucking learned the whole time I was playing those games. They're like, oh yeah, the pyramid, the big fucking overly tall pyramid that's in Rome. I know all about that. Thank you. I can't remember it now, but I was like, at the time I was playing through Assassin's Creed 2, and I fucking knew exactly what they were talking about. And then like all these other things too. I digress, but yeah, machine guns. The machine gun MOS. An MOS is a military occupational specialty. And my occupational specialty, which is job, it's just your fucking job in the military. They're number designated so that you don't have to say it all the way out. People just know what it is. And by people, I mean like officers and logistics people, because I don't know any fucking other MOSs other than the infantry ones. And you know, the first two letters, O3. That's your like track designation. So 03 means infantry, and then 31 is my actual job in the infantry. So I'm an infantry machine gunner, 03-31, and 03-11 is a rifleman, and 03-21 is recon. 03-41 was a mortarman. 03-51 is an anti-tank missileman. And 03-52 is an anti-tank guided missileman. And I think an 0361 is a sniper. And actually 61 and 21 are specialty, super specialty fields. And they have additional designations inside of them, I think. So like the 3-1 also just means that you're basic bitch machine gunner. So like 0331 means that you're a non-specialized specialty. So there's potentially, I guess, or there's supposed to be other ones. So like with the assault men, you have 0351 and 0352. But I think they actually got rid of the 0352 specialization anyway. But I think, especially with recon and snipers, I think that they go deeper. So they have like 0322, 0323 for like random shit that they need. I think the snipers have like special designations for certain types. I don't know. Any fucking Marine Corps sniper that's going to listen to this. I actually know one that might listen to this podcast. He's like, you're a fucking idiot. Stop talking out of pocket. I'm like, okay. But no, I started in the Marine Corps as a machine gunner. You know what? It's okay for me to talk about this because it was literally Veterans Day 2 days ago. And it was the Marine Corps birthday. Yeet. 2 days before that. And man, it's just it's a time of the year where I think about the military more than I normally do, which is almost all the time anyway. With the lingering wonders of PTSD, you too can dream about fucking up things that already passed successfully in your life 10 to 15 years ago as well. Which is pretty much what my day to day is like. Or a lot of my nights. I have nightmares where I've just lost my rifle and I wake up in a fucking cold sweat, like literally like my balls fucking shrank all the way up into my stomach. Fucking nightmare. Literally. But you know, I was an 0331, which is a machine gunner, which is kind of a oddly obsolete MOS, but also not at all. So it's the only MOS after 0311, 0311 is basically everybody has to do 0311 training, which is rifleman training, to some degree, even the pogues do. But then the riflemen kind of go extra hard in their own thing. And they get really, really good at breaching houses and stuff like that. But if you're any of the other specializations, except for recon, not technically, you have to become extraordinarily proficient in certain weapons. You're literally get put into weapons platoons. So sniper rifle people get really, really good at different sniper rifles. So they can use the M40 really good. They can use the Sasser, the Barrett Sasser really good. They can use the this, that, and the other fucking all these DRMs, and they can use all the spotting equipment. For machine gunners, you can use all the machine guns. So I know how to shoot every infantry grade machine gun in the United States Marine Corps. I was just hazed so badly. I can probably still take them apart and put them back together. Even now, even the M250 caliber machine gun, the Maw fucking Deuce, dude, that thing has like legitimately, I think it's 65 different parts inside the bolt alone. And like, or in total, it's probably more like 20 or something, but it just seems like so much. The tiny little wrench shaped pieces. If you put them in backwards, the gun won't work at all. But I digress. The good thing about the machine gun MOS is they still teach you how to, and I mean, shit might have changed. It's been fucking almost 15 years now, but they teach you how to employ the weapons and stuff and how to take them apart, how to clean them, and to the point where you're kind of invaluable in certain situations because people still get 240s, M240 Gulf medium machine guns, or M240 Bravos, whichever kind of deal you're using, they still get those to put them on top of vehicles. In addition to if you're in a weapons company, much heavier ordnance like the M250 Cal, or my personal favorite, the Mark 19 fucking heavy grenade launcher, which is just literally... it's akin to a sort of like it's almost sexual how fucking powerful that gun is. It's a machine gun that shoots grenades. Like, I don't even know how to explain that. It is the funnest fucking thing to shoot, and the most dangerous of the weapons that the machine gunners can use, because the grenades can just get stuck in the barrel and explode. It's called stove piping or banana peeling. I literally blow the end of it open like a fucking cartoon. It looks like a fucking old Looney Tunes cartoon where they blow the end of a gun up. And I digress, and just ignore my perverse attraction to heavy weapons. It's a lingering ailment for my time in the Marines. But a lot of the employment of the weapons is kind of old school. Things might have changed, but I was in the heart of the Iraq War. I went in 2005. Jesus fucking Christ. I thought I was overselling 15 years, and I was, but only by a year. I went in and, 2005, I graduated. By that time, a year later, I was already on my first deployment. So in that time, you know, I graduated boot camp, and then I graduated the two-ish, I think, month. I think SOI is 2 months, 2 or 3 month SOI course. And that's School of Infantry. And then went to my unit, 2nd Battalion, 8th Marines. And then I did gangster shit from there with some of the most like legitimately hardcore motherfuckers on the planet Earth. But when we were teaching, they were teaching us how to employ the weapons. We were like learning trench warfare shit. So it's like, you know, like, hey, run up here on a berm and shoot from like this area and lay down suppressive fire so that people can approach an objective. And that's like not even what you do most of the time, almost ever. I mean, it's a functional and a valid tactic, but it's like, dude, I went on 3 fucking deployments. We never used it once, because you can't really do it against non-conventional forces, because you can't just lay down a field of fire into a city. You can, but you're going to end up on the CNN, and Hillary Clinton's going to call you a monster. She's the real monster. No, I'm just kidding. No, she gets fucking, that lady gets more bloodlust excited for a fucking kill than almost anyone I ever met in the Marine Corps. You should look up the video of her talking about killing Gaddafi. Dude, she gets fucking, she goes in. She's really excited when they got him. I digress. So that was just a weird thing. And now you guys know a little bit more about it, but When we use the guns, most of the time it's all top of the car patrol based. So like you put your medium machine gun up on top of a Humvee or a fucking 2-ton, 7-ton MRAP, Cougar, whatever the fuck they're calling them right now. I can't remember the goddamn different things, but a million different trucks. Every single one of them has basically the same fucking turret assembly with minor differences, but the things go in the same. And then you're just half the time teaching a bunch of fucking idiots how to, and by idiots, I mean infantry, riflemen, which, crayon eaters, close to my heart, crayon eaters, teaching them how to use weapons that are legitimately above their fucking intellectual pay grade half the time. I don't know what it is, but dude, you get dudes that are so confident that they seem like they're smart as shit, and then you have to like ask them to do some basic stuff, and you're like, fuck, dude, what fucking ASVAB score did you get to get in the military, and you legitimately cannot comprehend how to fucking lift a feed tray on a 240? It's the same as the saw. Like, don't make fun of me. My teeth are full of crayons. I can't think with you yelling at me. Dude, we talk by yelling. What the fuck are you talking about? I digress. There's a lot of really smart riflemen out there. Intellect and placement in the Marine Corps just makes no fucking sense, because as dumb as some of the guys I was in the fucking infantry with, I swear to God, man, you'll run into people in S1, S2 shops that are fucking unreal. That's like logistics and intel. S1 is intel. Intel people are a fucking dice roll. That's why half the time you find out somebody was crazy and they became a serial killer after the military. Oh, let me guess, not infantry. They were in fucking intel. And they're like, yes, they were in intel. Like, you sociopaths fucking love each other. I don't know what it is, but that whole area, they just attract the fucking biggest collection of mental deficients. It is mind blowing. I digress. So with that little bit of military history out of the way, and you know, it's Veterans Day, basically. I'm recording it 2 days after. It's going to come out less than a week after Veterans Day. But as a final caveat to that, before I hop into the reviews, let me just say thank you, everybody. Every veteran that's out there, and you served honorably. Thanks, man. Anybody that served dishonorably, eat shit. Fucking idiot. What the fuck? How did you fuck that up? Dishonorable. Dude, it is so hard to get a dishonorable discharge. It's literally like, it's basically fucking, you have to almost murder or like rape somebody or be caught like hardcore drug peddling to get a dishonorable discharge. It's not as cool as in the movies, where you like punch an officer in the face. How'd you get a dishonorable discharge?
My officer said, shoot these fucking civilians. So I punched him in the face.
Never happens. I've seen officers get fucking punched in the face by Marines for fucking up in combat. Hardcore, a fucking swift thrust to your jaw off the wrist launcher flat out, bro. And they were taken up on NJP that was dismissed because the colonel found out and was like, are you fucking serious, Lieutenant? You're lucky he hit you because you'd all be dead instead, you fucking moron. All that happens is you get fucking delayed for picking up rank. Like, oh, I'm not going to make corporal in my 4 years in the fucking infantry. Oh, what now? As though I was ever going to pick up with these fucking MOS grades in the first place. Eat shit. I'll take it on the chin. No, most of the time, people get a dishonorable discharge. They are fuck ups, dude. I know guys that got kicked out. Kicked the fuck out of the military. Spent the entire time, the rest of the time, they're in the brig. They spent their entire time in the brig, plus like an additional amount of time because they committed a war crime of sorts, and they still got a fucking like ADSEG medical discharge, which after a while can become like close to, but not quite, an honorable discharge. Your boy Tyler Bell, host, creator, and sometime guitarist for the West Side Fairy Tales, honorable discharge, straight up, still got NJP'd at least twice while I was in the Marines. Still got out with my good conduct award, though. So, blah, blah. For real, anybody that was in the military, thanks a bunch for your service. Thanks for your support, especially. I get a lot of stuff. I get a lot of letters from guys that were in the military that are just happy to see a vet doing it. Because I'm not going to lie, it doesn't seem like you can. There's tons of veterans that end up in, you know, creative fields and stuff, but it's not a place where you feel like you have a lot of individual value when you get out. Not a lot of people get out of the military feeling really good about themselves, even if they say a lot of like pro self-confident things. It's a real mind fuck being in the military and then getting out of it and being like, you know, I can do something on my own because I can create things. It doesn't always quite work like that. But, you know, if you're out there and you're a veteran, you're thinking about trying to make something, if you want to write stories about, if you even just want to try to tell the story of your own time while you were in, go for it, dude. Just fucking go for it. Don't let yourself get hung up on, you know, like, oh man, the guys found out I was trying to be creative and shit like this. They would make fun of me. You remember that one time you told a joke and it didn't go over well in the cafeteria and that shit just fucking like lays on your heart, the mess hall. Don't let yourself get hung up. Go ahead and try to make some shit. Go ahead, learn how to draw, learn how to fucking type, and then just stick with it and make some stuff. And you know, we're out there for you. And honestly, not a lot of people say this, but because it's not as important, but I still think it's an important thing to say to all the people who support military people out there, especially sons, daughters, wives, mothers, husbands, and fathers, like, y'all motherfuckers are the glue, really, that holds the military together. The military is its own sort of family, but it's so fucked up and defunct and incestuous that no one should ever claim it, unless you're an infantry machine gunner. Best brotherhood on earth. Fuck the police. Goddamn infantry. The most savage of cats. But no, for real, like, if you're out there and you've got people serving and, you know, you stick by them, it sucks waiting for people to come home. It especially sucks knowing if you're, you know, an infantry wife or an infantry mom or dad, like waiting for people to come home, especially like when I was out there. I wasn't out there 06, 07 and 09 and 08, but not all of it. just 20 months total. When I was out there, I know it was hell on my mom and dad. And every time they turned on the news, they were like, wait to see my picture. Because the news finds out shit way before the fucking military can get out there. And I know it's a nightmare. There's still people out there fucking scrapping in Afghanistan and in Iraq and shit today. So, hey, from the West Side Fairy Tales family out to yours, like, stay strong. Be some badass Blue Star people and keep supporting your vets. On that note, into our first story, which is even more darker than the mildly dark stuff I was just talking about. So the literature recommendation for this month is Beloved by Toni Morrison, which was written in, well, not written, but published in 1987. And I'm going to tell you a little bit about Toni Morrison because she's a really incredible person. She unfortunately died in August of this year. She died on August 5th in New York City. She was born in Lorain, Ohio, February 18th, 31. So when we kind of get into the context of the stories we're going to be telling, these are stories that she was probably, she most certainly grew up hearing from people. Because it's weird to think, you know, you think of America in these little chunks in these time periods and the people that were most notable in those time periods, but you do kind of forget that there's transition times. And, you know, everybody from the 1980s doesn't die because the fucking 1990s roll out. And it's very much the same. If you were born in 1931, you very certainly grew up knowing people that were former slaves, even if they were old. And more than likely, if you were a Black American, you were directly one or two generations at best, you know, separated from out and out full on ankle chain slavery, which is to this day in a list of the atrocities that my country has committed, I would say really close to the top, if not the top spot. The only other people that could kind of knock you for it would be the Native Americans, and I don't think they're really in a pissing contest with Black America over who got fucked harder by the white man. But yeah, it was real bad. It was real bad on both sides, all sides. Yeah, don't even really know how to hop into this, but Toni Morrison, she came from that. Or you know, even if not quite from so close as to be indiscernible. And Lorain, Ohio is, I'm pretty sure, pretty close to Cincinnati, if not like one of those like suburbs that's technically Cincinnati. I don't know it personally, but most of Beloved, the novel that we're going to be talking to, takes place in Cincy. And Cincinnati is an odd city with a strange racial heritage in relationship to race and racism and slavery. It's literally a bad taste in your mouth, but not an absolutely broken heart. Is the way I kind of think of my hometown. I was born and raised in Cincinnati, by the way. I think I mentioned that a little bit earlier in the podcast. But I'm from the west side of Cincinnati, so I am a Cincinnati person. I was born in, I think, in Price Hill. I was baptized in Price Hill, fucking Holy Family Church, Catholic. And I grew up in Green Township. I went to St. Jude, then I went to Bridgetown after the Catholics wouldn't have me anymore, and I eventually graduated from high school at Oak Hills. So anyone that's from the city is like, oh shit, okay, the pedigree is in place. Yeah, so working class, Cincinnati background, that's me.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
hilariously upper class to some people I knew, hilariously lower class to other people's. A true middle class fucking blue collar person and family that I was. But Toni Morrison is from basically from my town, and she has a completely different perspective on the city than I would have ever had. If you don't know, Cincinnati was basically one of the biggest last stops on the Underground Railroad, to the point where it's a crucial thing to this telling, but also to a lot of other stories. There's, you know, the actual finish line for getting out of Antebellum South, the Antebellum. No, it would be the pre-bellum. Antebellum means after war, so the Pache Bellum. I can't remember my Latin. I'm sorry, but the before the war South, pre-war, full slavery, no emancipation proclamation South was the Ohio River into Cincinnati, and there were a lot of people in Cincinnati that would take care of slaves, and basically still even when you got across the river, like, the best part about that was the states did not have an active, or from what I understand, did not have like very much of an active, like, we're going to look for slave things, that, and people would just ignore you. They'd be like, okay, all right, go ahead. I don't care. As opposed to the South, where people would be like, well, that's human property, which just like, just even saying it's so fucking gross. But like, you know, once you got to the other side, it wasn't, you know, fucking sunshine and roses, but it was so much better than the other side of the fucking river that it kind of hard to even like describe. And honestly, like, a lot of Beloved is about that. But just to finish my Toni Morrison minor terrible biography, she was born in Lorain, Ohio. She was awarded the Pulitzer in 1988 for Beloved and the Nobel Prize in Literature in 1993. And she's the first black woman ever, period. The first black woman ever, period, to win a Nobel Prize, which is fucking amazing. She was also the first black female editor at Random House. And in May 2012, President Barack Obama, the first black president, awarded her the Presidential Medal of Freedom, which is the highest, I believe, the highest civilian award that you can be given in the United States, and by far the most prestigious. I believe it takes an act of Congress to get it. It's very similar to like the Medal of Honor. And for you Canadians and Australians and Brits out there, it would be similar to your OBEs and knightings. There's no title that goes along with it. Americans find titles hilariously disgusting. Actually do it to the point where even if you're a fucking like a tenured, like a full-time 30-year lawyer, if you call yourself whatever Esquire, like, people like gross. And even our newspapers don't call people doctor unless they're actually a medical doctor, which infuriates people with doctorates. But honestly, it's for the best, because your doctorate means literally nothing to the lay people. So why do I care if you have a doctorate in chemistry? I don't want anyone running to your house in the middle of a fucking emergency trying to get some staples done because they think that you're a real doctor, like a medical doctor. Anyone that's in academia right now is just like, I'm sorry. But that's not the entirety of Toni Morrison's like history. Please look her up. She's a very fascinating woman, and I can't even say like five words without going off on a tangent. If I tried to do Toni Morrison's biography on here, in addition to talking about the novel that she's most well known for, I'll never get to the second recommendation of the day. So, Beloved was published in 1987, and it's based on the story of a real woman named Margaret Garner, who has probably one of the most tragic but like unfortunately common sort of stories, but she did stand out. She ran across the Cincinnati side of the Ohio River during winter when the river was frozen over, which is a pretty common thing for people to do back then. You don't want to try to swim across the Cincinnati River. It's extremely broad and fairly busy. In the the summer months and stuff. So you're very likely to get spotted and caught even at night. They've got night barges and stuff going over, and people would go over by boat and stuff. You know, it's not like they would stop trying to run away from it. But the best time to go would be in the winter when it was frozen over, because then you had a straight shot to run across, and because if the current was especially strong, the current on the Ohio River leads straight back down into the south, into the Mississippi River. So, if you miss your shot and you float too far past the city, which is at the very, very corner, you're going to end up getting backtracked extremely fast. Like the river flows pretty quickly. I digress. Margaret Garner fled. This was in 1856. She escaped to Cincinnati, and she was famous for killing her child. She murdered her own infant daughter, I believe, with a butcher knife rather than let her be taken back into slavery when slave catchers, which was still legal under federal law, came up north of the river to bring her back to the man who said he owned her. I know the proper nomenclature, I guess you would say, to use in this, but like I don't want to ever fucking call someone else's master. It's so fucking gross. With the notable exception of my friendly freaks in the BDSM community, no one should ever be subjected to that sort of, even in memory. I don't like using it. So the man that said he owned her sent a federal marshals accompanied these people, and they hunted her down north of the Ohio River and found her. And rather than let her kid, who she knew would be taken back, this is still what, 8 years before the Civil War and the Emancipation Proclamation, and any surety that there would be truly free black women in America, black women and men in America, she could only operate off of the assumption that her daughter would be taken back. Her daughter was what they called at the time mulatto. She was mixed, and mixed because very obviously Margaret had been raped by her plantation owner, piece of shit, in fucking down in Kentucky. And actually, I think he lived in the Louisville area where I live now. So that's the nature of the two cities I've really called home in my life. And not far, you know, it's an hour and a half drive, but I mean, that walk was probably something in the line of, you know, a couple weeks at least, if not months, depending on the terrain and the heat in the area, so to say, the search heat, not the physical heat of the air. So it's so exhausting. But I shall persevere. So she killed her kid because she knew her kid, very much like her, would be sold into slavery. And as happened to women in that situation, she would probably be forcibly raped by other men, other black men who weren't necessarily willing to do this. They would be forced to, like farm animals, they would be forced to stud new children. They would be forced to have kids to be sold into slavery. And you know, that it's like, I don't even, and I'm gonna try not to like sermonize and shit during this. There is no part of my brain that will allow me to say like it was just the nature of the day that these things happened. It is impossible to me. Having met people from different cultures, having had to be cruel essentially in my capacity as an infantryman to people who did not speak my language and who could not communicate with me, that anyone would still be able to convince themselves that what they were doing was not inherently fucking evil. You know what I'm saying? Like it's fucking madness. Like there is no way. They're just slaves. Blah, 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 blah. Like, dude, you knew what you were doing. You knew what you were fucking doing. Honestly, being a guy from Ohio, I think my one feel about the South during the Civil War was that Sherman didn't go hard enough. I hear people that have complained about like William Tecumseh Sherman, marching down south and burning everything he fucking saw. Maybe I don't know enough about it, but if I could have burnt plantations and cities built on slavery to the fucking ground, I wouldn't have stopped at Atlanta. I would have just kept going until I ran out of cities. And that's how I feel about that. Back to the story. Sorry. Sorry if you're from the South, but that's, I'm not sorry. I stand behind that 100%. I lived in Virginia. You think you know about racism, hearing it and stuff, and like institutional racism and shit, until I lived in fucking Virginia and I saw memorials to the Confederate dead bigger than fucking churches, and like black people having to fucking like just live near that shit. Like, fuck, bro. Like, you remember when we almost kept you down? That's the rock we give to our dead. We're not even going to build you a fucking school, but we will spend $100,000 on marble to build a gigantic fucking obelisk to dead Confederate soldiers. Like, literally suck my fucking dick, dude. Eat shit. I digress for the fifth time. No one needs me to be mad about this. Everyone else can be mad about it. So Margaret Garner was found. She was arrested and she was sent back to Kentucky. And the Ohio authorities actually did a lot. The prosecutor actually in Cincinnati wanted to charge her with murder, knowing full well the extent of the crime, and honestly, I think even on the record saying like they understood why she did it, why she would kill a child instead of letting a child live in the fucking horrors of the slavery South, and literally why he wanted to charge her for murder was because he wanted to charge her for murder as a person, as opposed to how she would be charged under traditional federal law, which is as a piece of property. So there's that. And if he was able to charge her and convict her for murder, A, she would go to jail in Cincinnati and not have to go back to slavery in the South, which is... I can't even imagine how that is the better of the two situations, but it very clearly is, given what she would be subjected to. I think she might have still been with inside her childbearing years and abilities. So, you know, she would have gone right back. They would have put her right back to what they were doing to her beforehand. And if he would have successfully prosecuted and charged her with murder, it could have set up an argument in the Supreme Court ahead of Emancipation Proclamation to establish the legal identity of Black Americans as people instead of chattel, which is like, ugh. Sorry, I'm getting like pissed here. I'm going to continue on. So she was actually... And this is the real person. This is the real person before we even get into the story. She was sent back to Kentucky, and to avoid the authorities, because the Cincinnati or the Hamilton County would have been the Hamilton County Sheriff's Office was charged with going down south and arresting her, because a warrant was, she was returned to Kentucky. But while they were processing the warrant, she was sent back down to Louisville. And the sheriffs were charged with issuing the warrant, but they could not find her because the slave master, piece of shit, fucking kept moving her around. So they couldn't find her, arrest her, quote unquote, and then bring her back to Cincinnati. And eventually he sold her to his brother in Arkansas, who sold her to some sort of plantation home, I think in New Orleans, where she eventually died in 1958 of typhoid fever. If you don't know what typhus is, it is like one of the worst fucking diseases you can get. And it's literally a disease that kills like the poor and filthy. Like it comes from It literally gets into houses, from what I understand. One of my favorite books, or literally my favorite book, Voices of Glory, which I'll eventually recommend and talk about at length, but I get all weepy when I think about it. One of the woman is very concerned with health in it. Basically the main character, and she talks at length about typhus. And if there's a house where people are getting typhus, you literally have to demolish it and open sewage pits and stuff is how you get it. And it will destroy a fucking community. And there was an outbreak where she was, where Margaret Garner was, and it killed her. Her husband, everything that's known about Margaret after she was taken out of Cincinnati is actually known by her, or was told to a Cincinnati paper that no longer exists. I can't remember the name of it off the top of my head, but her husband, slave husband, Robert Garner, they tracked him down and asked about it. And apparently her last words to him were that he should never marry again in slavery, but to live in hope of freedom. So that, you know, I mean, I don't really know what else to say on top of that. But that's the real story of the woman behind the main character, Setha. I'm not going to be able to say it right. I think it's actually pronounced, it's spelled S-E-T-H-E, and I think it's pronounced Setha. Setha? Like Setha? Like that? But I can't, if I don't focus on it, I can't do it right, so I'm probably going to call her Seth. And honestly, when I read the book, I call it Setha. So it's just, I'm not trying to diss the character. I literally won't remember to say it the right way because my brain isn't very good with that sort of thing. So Beloved concerns a stand-in for the Margaret Garner real person. Her name's Setha, and she is a slave on a plantation called Sweet Home. In Kentucky, I think it might have been in Lexington, but I can't remember correctly. But it was a Kentucky plantation. And you can drive through the same areas today. They are not gone. You can sometimes see the same old plantation houses. They have farms where they have horses now and stuff, but it's good old sun shines bright on my old Kentucky home. You know, that fucking song sounds just so racist, even if it's not, I don't know why. But she's from a plantation in Kentucky. And it is a plantation notable because as you find out over the course of time, the original owner, who's still a fucking a slave owner, is a good slave owner. And that he treats slaves like men. He treats the male slaves like men. He doesn't call them boy. He asks them their opinions on things. He allows them the run of the farm in general. But they can't ever leave. They can't ever walk out off of the property, because if they do, you know, people talk, and it's the South, so they'll just hang them. They'll fucking lynch people because the slave talked too funny and shit. Because honestly, at this point, even all these fucking slave masters and owners and shit knew what they were doing was instinctually wrong, and that if they didn't continually create a continuous campaign of fear against people, that they would be mutilated, emasculated. Emasculation was a thing, if you don't understand what I mean by that. Literally gelding men, cutting off their testicles or their testicles and their penis wholesale, depending on how badly you wanted to punish them. Which is nightmarish, you know what I'm saying? That would happen just because you're talking out of turn, and worse, use your imagination. It's one of those things where these medieval torture things came back, that it's unthinkable to do it to any misbehaving animal. You kind of have to do it. You have to put dogs in, like, you know, choker collars, like larger dogs, just because their neck is literally so thick they can't feel it. And even that makes me feel bad, and I would rather just have my dog really well behaved to my commands. That makes me feel bad. Much less like any of the shit they just did to people. It makes no fucking sense. It like it there is no part of my mind where it's like, yeah, this is, I understand how you got here. It's the evil is so fundamental, and it's, you know, you have to get inside the minds of these people and literally just start doing mental gymnastics over mental gymnastics to like get behind where they went to. But on Sweet Home, you know, the guy that runs it, he says, I treat my boys like men, something stupid like that. But eventually Sweet Home is taken over by that man's brother-in-law after his untimely death. He has a stroke, I believe, and it kills him. His wife, who is also a very nice and understanding woman, despite being a fucking slave owner, kind of just gets sick and collapses on herself spiritually while her brother takes over the farm and just flips the dial to a full 10 out of 10 misery fest for all the black people that are living there against their will. And this is all told out of order. There's about four or five different stories going on the entire time, and they're all sort of told out of order and woven amongst each other. The book itself is very short. I read it over 2 days, in like 2, 3, or 4 hour sessions and got the entirety of it out. Actually, I read it over 3 days. But it's a really, really trippy novel. And it's just, it's probably the best way to experience all this stuff, because she packs so much information, into these pages. And you get a lot to learn about all these characters. There's also Paul D, who is her eventual boyfriend, sort of man in her life, later after Setha escapes from slavery. She runs away off the plantation. They all do at the same time. One of their number doesn't make it. A guy named Sixo, who is caught, his feet are burned, and he's eventually shot because he realizes that the slave runners, the woman that he was in love with, who was pregnant with his child, got away. And it's not Setha, it's a different woman entirely. And he starts singing the kid's name and laughing because he knows that kid isn't going to be caught by these men, which is like, it's an incredibly powerful, if short scene. From there they go to the other side of the river. Paul D is caught shortly after this. I think he kind of just bums around through, most of America, which kind of highlights the, like, if you don't understand things about slavery, especially if you come from, you know, honestly, if you don't understand things about institutionalization, which is really one of the larger themes in this, although no one's really talked about it because, you know, it's slavery kind of obviously overshadows it, but it is very much the institutionalized mindset, which I understand from being in the military. You get out, and once the structure, no matter how painful the structure was, the structure can take you apart so that it's the only thing that's holding you up. And once it's gone, you actually end up missing it to a certain degree in an ugly way, because it was at least, you know, something that could keep you together, even though it's what really broke you. And even if you're trying to flee that thing, you'll find other things that are similar to it. You know what I mean? And slip back into that role because you've been broken as a person into believing that existence is the one that you're supposed to live, which is one of the more overarching themes of the book, in my mind, at least. But Paul D runs away, and he ends up talking to some Cherokee folk, and they point him on the right direction to get north. He never knows if he's made it north until he finally arrives at what they consider the north, which is where a certain blooming flower, you stop seeing it, and he gets all the way to fucking Vermont. Because, you know, it's kind of a nod to the fact that what's north and south doesn't necessarily conform to the borders that, you know, the Americans established after they took over the United States landmass. There's so much ugliness in this book, but he ends up on a chain gang, which is like legitimately one of the most nightmarish scenes in the book. They like live in a hole, and one day they all escape basically because it's either do or die, because the hole starts fucking flooding. And they basically push their ways out, and they all run for it. And ultimately, they all come to live in this house north of the Ohio River, where Baby Suga, who is, that's what the woman's called. She's an old woman, but that's what they call her because that's what her sort of name was to the other slaves. And she had a quote unquote real name that was on her slave papers. And she's like, that's not my fucking name. My name is the name that I'm called. Stop trying to give me new names. That ain't my shit. You know what I'm saying? So, and then the main events of the story happen, and Setha is confronted basically by the slave catchers and the federal marshal, and she kills her kid. She slits one of them's throat and tries to bash the other one's brains in against the wall, but only manages to kill the one. And so in that act of murder, their house, which is, I think, called I-91, I think it's the name of the house. I think it's just its address. It becomes to be haunted by the spirit of that little dead girl. And it bothers her other daughter, who's trying to grow up. And from there, you get into the real crux of the story, which I'm not going to go into 100%, but I did want to lay out all of that sort of preamble to the main story, just to talk about a little bit of the thematic things that I really like about it. And one of the most important ones, I think, and especially looking at what Toni Morrison herself said about it, is that, cause there's two more books in this. It's very much like, Dante's Inferno, where there's one book that everyone knows and it's by far the ugliest of them. And then there's two other books in the quote unquote beloved trilogy, which I have not read, much like, Dante's Inferno. I've not read the Paradiso or the Purgatorio. So, and maybe one day, he says, knowing that day will never come. With those two, at least, I might read the rest of Toni Morrison stuff. But it's, you know, Seth is haunted by this ghost, which is a the best kind of ghost, which is a maybe it's there, maybe it's not, and it's kind of haunting everybody. It's very, very directly described as being a physical thing that is at times both repulsing and enticing to members of the house for different reasons. Her daughter likes the ghost beloved because she wants a sister and she wants companionship because her mother is often very distant. People think that she's uppity, is what they call it. Like she puts on airs and stuff. And she's sort of aloof and, you know, like kind of a, she's got a holier than thou thing when in fact she's actually just very, very depressed and, anxiety riddled and suffering from extraordinarily bad PTSD symptoms, in all honesty. And a lot of survivor's guilt and guilt in general, for various things that she's done or had to do or if had done to her. And you know, so she's an aloof, lonely person because of this. And it's very sad. It's even more sad because I understand that character. I mean, obviously I can't quite wear her shoes, but I've had them on my feet, after a fashion. You know, I've had survivor's guilt. I still have survivor's guilt to this day. It's a fucking nightmare. I've had the fortunate, you know, the fortune for myself to have been able to talk to people, that understand these things, and understand the power of forgiving, not even necessarily other people, but especially yourself for things, and especially for things that you don't have any control over. Sorry, I thought I heard a very odd noise. Maybe I did, maybe I didn't. But, I think it was my phone was vibrating against my, yeah, okay, yeah, Jesus Christ, that scared the fuck out of me. Ruining the seriousness of the conversation. But, yeah, so that's why she's kind of isolated from other people, and she's got terrible, terrible scars on her back and, inside of her as well, that, you know, the scars on her back are a tree, they say, and, you know, it's got its roots are deep, deep inside of her, like beneath the flesh. And she feels ugly for the things that have been done to her and for the things that she's done to survive. In the immediate aftermath of the first phase of their escape attempt, which fails, she's caught by two of the men who work for a school teacher, who's the guy that takes over the Sweet Home plantation after the death of his brother-in-law. And they hold her down, rape her, and steal her breast milk. She's a pregnant woman. They literally steal her breast milk from her, which I can't even, like, what do you say? What the fuck do you say to that? And it's an extraordinarily powerful image. It's horrifying. It's disgusting, but you don't get to, I say this, especially anybody that's listened to Monstro, which I wrote, I don't believe it's okay for me to blink or look away or grimace in that instance. Because you know what? We have to share and carry that burden because it did happen. You know what I'm saying? And you can't make that person feel better by ignoring it, which is very much what kind of happens to her in this. And that is where Beloved is. And she has interactions with other characters and stuff. And I'll leave that to you if you haven't read the book or if you have, because I could fucking go on about this all day. And speaking of going on about this all day, this is one of the very first Oprah's Book Club books. And by far, I think the biggest of the Oprah's Book Club successes, to the point where I think Oprah herself, she had Toni Morrison on her show. If you guys don't know who Oprah is, man, I just realized that recently that people might not know who Oprah Winfrey is anymore, other than like a kind of a name. But like, she was one of the most powerful people on earth in the entertainment industry for a while. She was a fucking kingmaker. Using just the most strict sense of the term, or the least strict sense of the term. I don't know. I digress. But she was on record as saying there wouldn't really have been an Oprah's Book Club if she hadn't been able to recommend, if it wasn't for Toni Morrison's wonderful love of words and desire to share them with the world. So like she suggested that book on like national television during the daytime, and it's wonderful that it's out there. I mean, it really is, because you can forget stuff. I mean, and you shouldn't, but you should, but you shouldn't. You know what I'm saying? Like, well, actually, no, you just shouldn't forget stuff. You should forgive things. It's the hardest thing to do. It's the hardest thing to do, and you can't tell somebody to forgive other people. You can suggest it. You can suggest for people to forgive themselves. You can't make them do it, or it cheapens the experience. I tell you that as a person that has experienced some things personally, you know. But like, don't worry, I didn't do anything horrific. most of what I hate myself for is fairly banal. But that is very much what the character of Beloved represents, is the things that you have lost and sort of overblown in your mind, you know, innocence and beauty and youth and promise, and how all those things, the character of Beloved is a greedy, selfish, and self-absorbed monster of sorts. And by the end of the book, she has literally, they say, and she's grown to overshadow the woman who is her mother, so to say. And I think that works on a, obviously the direct level is a horrifying image, but as a metaphorical construct, it's fairly amazing. She let her guilt and her truly nostalgia for in the most direct sense of the word, there's a better German word for what I'm trying to think of, but I can't quite bring it to mind. But basically getting lost in the daydream of how much better life would have been if, you know, things would have gone right here, or things would have gone wrong for other people, and you could have had this fantasy, this utopia, basically. That's what Beloved comes to exist. And eventually it's not, I think most importantly to this story, and this isn't something that you see very often in American films in general, and I really wish it was there, is that she doesn't have the ability to shake it off on her own. Her community comes out. All of the women in her community come out to shake this demon basically out of this woman's home, both physically and metaphorically. It's actually done. A woman just strides up and clocks Setha when she runs up to try to stab a guy. But that's all kind of moot to the point, although it's not. But I'm sorry. I get tangled. It's a very tangly story, by the way. You will, if you haven't read it yet and you're trying to see whether or not you're going to get into it, you have to get past the first like 20, 30 pages. And then like it'll all come, it'll hit you like a fucking, like a pile driver, where you get the first impact and you're like, what? And then the shot will land and you'll be like, oh, God damn it. This is really good. This is really good. But yeah, you know, sometimes and not even sometimes, most of the time it takes, you know, other people just working on you and working on you for a while to help you get back to where you need to be in her case, to just to be a human being that's her own person again. Because that's another thing that kind of, I don't know if people have really talked about too. I didn't really read, I don't ever read other people's criticisms on books unless I'm forced to for college. And I haven't been in college for almost 10 years now. God, that's actually true. It's like 8. No. When did I graduate? 6 years ago. but, yeah, she, like I said earlier, she reverts to, because she doesn't understand how to be her own person, she reverts to becoming a servant again and serving someone and waiting on them hand and foot thanklessly. And the crazy part about it is when it's described in context of white on black enslavement, it's treated as matter of course in the description. But when it's a woman, you know, debasing herself to serve the whims of this spoiled child who's a ghost, only then is it like, hey, this is fucking wrong. You're like, you're mistreating yourself. You're not being like real to yourself. You gotta fucking put that child in line, kind of thing. And I think that's the seed that's supposed to spread out from there. Is it's you're supposed to understand in that final lesson that all of that lesson should backdate itself to the entirety of the thing, where it's there should never have been a point where she was just, you know, kowtowing to these people on this fucking plantation just because they fucking say that they owned her and all of this stuff. And that wasn't right. And that's not how you need to live. And that's not how you should think of yourself ever. You shouldn't ever think of yourself as a fucking servant, because no one is, you know what I'm saying? No one's meant to live like that. And that's beloved. 10 out of 10, highly recommended. And I think my final note for this is that, the book was banned by 5 schools, I think, in America, is what I've read. Most notably in Virginia, where I lived for a small amount of time. I think that was in Fairfax County, though. So that'd been up north, like Washington, D.C., Virginia, and at Eastern fucking High School here in Louisville, Kentucky. And, you know, that would have been in during my lifetime in the last 30 years. And it was ostensibly because of the depictions of, and I haven't even gotten to everything that happens, there's bestiality in this, there's rape, racism, obviously, the descriptions of antebellum treatment of Black Americans, and before the slave trade, and incest, and all sorts of horrific shit, dude, piled upon piles. And yeah, and Louisville was like, oh, this is just too much. only when you must remember it is the weight too high. But when you carried it was the weight so low. But that is beloved. I highly recommend it, to the point where I would say that is a must read for anybody that's an American. You should have to read that book at some point, just because people lose their context, and it's unacceptable. I'm gonna digress one more time before doing a commercial. if you haven't been watching the Watchmen series that's on HBO, I really like it. I think it's pretty good right now. I was watching it, and at the beginning, there is this scene that takes place in Tulsa, Oklahoma, back in the 1930s, 40s. And there's men driving in, Ku Klux Klan members, just driving into a street in broad daylight and like shooting black people down and beating people and dragging them behind cars in like semi-modern America, you know, cars and telephones America, and breaking up storefronts. And a guy is even flying a fucking airplane over the street and dropping bombs down. And I said, well, that's a little overblown, isn't it? Wrong. That actually fucking happened. The Tulsa, Oklahoma riots of I think 1946 or something actually fucking happened. And there was thousands of Klan members turned out to it, and they were literally dropping fucking explosives on people from personally owned small propeller aircraft. And I've never even heard of that. That blows my fucking mind. a fucking terrorist organization literally declared war on a city inside of America and successfully attacked it and then left. Fucking mind-blowing. So yeah, don't forget, don't lose your context. That's the purpose of Veterans Day, and I believe that's the purpose of books like this. Toni Morrison herself suggested that there is no war memorial for the 60 million. The 60 million dead is the proposed number of black men and women, some African-born, some American-born, who died during the entirety of the slave trade, many of whom, an almost untold number, on the ships that took slaves from Africa to America. And they're like, a lot of numbers suggest that roughly half of the stock, so to say, in the holds of the ships, half of those people would die in transit. Moving on. I'm sorry. As you guys know, some of you guys know, I'm part of the Himalaya Network now, and we do advertisements for each other, for other podcasts that are on. And I'm going to tell you guys about some podcasts. Please chipper up, try to cheer yourself up, get a little pep in your heart. Don't worry, we're going to talk about a funny movie after this. And I'm going to talk to you guys about another cool show. If you're a fan of the West Side Fairy Tales, then I think Crime Lines and Box of Oddities will be right up your alley. Crime Lines walks you through true crime events, pairing captivating tales with clear storytelling. Host Charlie Worrell, pronounced Warrell. Oh shit, I wasn't supposed to read that, but I did anyway. Host Charlie Worrell, I pronounced it wrong. Host Charlie Worrell gives the most in-depth analysis by bringing an appropriate historic and cultural context to look beyond simply what happened, to consider why. Download the Himalaya app, search Crime Lines, and enter promo code Charlie for your first month of premium content absolutely free. Again, search for Crime Lines and enter promo code Charlie, that's CHARLIE, for 30 days of free premium content. Another great show worth your time is The Box of Oddities, hosted by the dynamic duo Kat and Jethra Gilligan Toth. Twice a week, the couple surprises each other and their listeners with stories of the strange, bizarre, and the unexpected. Download the Himalaya app, search for Box of Oddities, and enter promo code BOX, that's B-O-X, for your first month of premium content absolutely free. So what are you waiting for? Go check out Crime Lines and Box of Oddities on the Himalaya app today. I sincerely enjoy both shows, and you will too. So, oh my lord, I'm going to drink a little bit of water because I've been yammering. It's going to be a long episode. So I won't take too long on Society, but it's just a great film. So Society is a 1989 film released in 1992 by director Brian Usna. who's the guy behind Reanimator. I think he's actually the Reanimator himself too. It stars Billy Warlock, who is a guy from Baywatch, Devin DeVasquez, Evan Richardson, and Ben Meyerson. And this is a fucking crazy movie. You should absolutely watch it. It's on Shudder. Shudder's not a sponsor, but you should fucking get Shudder anyway. I really want Shudder as a sponsor just so I can get it for free because it's fucking awesome. It's a horror movie streaming service, but Society is on there. The movie starts off strong. I didn't mean to blow the mic out there. The movie starts off strong, like very strong. It is so fucking great. And it's kind of campy, and especially campy at the end when it kind of arguably shouldn't be, because I could do a remake of this movie and I would make it so much fucking worse. It literally could have been almost to like a fucking, well, maybe not quite Jacob's Ladder, but definitely like a top 10 horror movie if it would have been played a little less tongue in cheek, but it wasn't. But that doesn't matter. It is ostensibly a body horror flick, and it's the body horror stuff is fucking great. Like just misangled legs and arms, accidental extra limbs or fingers and eyes in odd places throughout the beginning of the film. It concerns a young man named Bill, who was taken in by a family of aristocratic Californians, I believe they are, and. His sister, who's slightly younger than him, is about to have her, they call it her coming out, which is a real thing. It's a holdover from old Europe when, young women between the ages of, I think it used to be between the ages of about 10 and 12, but now it's between the ages of like 14 and 16, which is slightly better, kind of announce themselves to society, in that very particular British sense, as in not poor people, but all the rich people that make decisions for real, and rich titled people. You know what I'm saying? Not this is much more American. So you know, while they have the it's much more Monopoly Man than Lords and Ladies. But the original coming outs were literally to. Basically stretch your girl around and let everyone, you're literally just trying to sell your daughter. it's a daughter auction that's what coming out is. It's very painted. It's painted very nicely, but it's like, hey, look, she's pretty and she speak good. Now show them you can dance, honey. Show them how you dance. And, right around then is when things get weird. So she had a boyfriend right before the coming out ceremony. And he thinks that she's been acting very weird, and he's been acting very weird by stalking her. And he bugs the coming out ceremony, and you hear, first we eat, then copulation. And so like they have an orgy, like a gross fucking gross rich people orgy. And from there the mystery sort of begins. That guy goes missing shortly after. And Bill starts noticing odd things about not only his family, but some of the other wealthy families in their social circle, one of which has a girl he's mildly attracted to and who is mildly attracted to him. Her hips start going in the wrong direction while she's laying in bed one time. And he's like, hey, wait, what? And he looks at her again and everything's fine. You come to find out that the rich are quite literally eating the poor, and not only are they doing that, but they are an alien race, not quite alien necessarily. I believe at one point the dude's father, or actually the head of the societal circle, a judge like Harkness or whatever his name is, says that they've been there longer than people. That the people are the aliens or something of that nature, but. You find out that they eat through a ceremonial orgy called the shunt. The only thing better than the smell of the hunt is the taste of the shunt. And from there, man, we go full body horror, and that's the last the ass end of the movie. And it is just a fucking blast start to finish. I had so much fun. Even the ending of it, it's a little too corny for its own good. If they would have pulled back the wackiness, like a fucking touch, it would have still been hilarious. But the effects are done by a guy named Screaming Mad George, who is, I believe, a Japanese dude, who did a lot of other stuff too, but his effects, his creature effects and stuff are just fucking top notch. And the end of the movie ends with a lot of people just connected with like a 7 or 8 different colored wads of taffy all kind of pushed together. There's some fisting, some death by fisting. There's actually 2 deaths by fisting now that I recall. And the show is just, it's just amazing. I don't even know really what to add on top of that, but it is fucking incredible. Not really much of an inspirational movie, other than I want to remake it myself and make it way darker. If you want to watch anything from the movie, literally just watch the intro. The intro for Society is fucking foul and wonderful. It's great. It's a very, very Jacob's Ladder-y type scene. It's static. I think it's a single long shot that doesn't move very much. It's just you don't know really what you're looking at most of the time. And I can't recommend it enough. Just check it out and then come back and tell me what you think about it, really, because that's what I'm most interested in. Oh, wow. Man, I've been talking for 1 hour and 20 minutes. I really wish I could go more on about Society, but there really isn't too much to say about it. Unfortunately, unlike the seminal novel about slavery and overcoming the sort of mental difficulties of readjusting to society after an extraordinary trauma that is Toni Morrison's beloved, Society is just not quite as interesting to talk about. And, you know, sorry if I got a little emotional during certain parts of that. It would be more odd if people can just kind of blithely talk about those sort of things without, I don't know, feeling enough that it kind of knocks you off of your step. But I just want people to know, I'm not trying to impress anyone. I'm not like a woke type person. I don't want to tell you what to think. That's just what I think. And I feel very strongly in those regards. But all that aside, if you enjoyed this episode of the Horror and Lit Club, come talk about it with everyone else in the Horror and Lit Club on Facebook. Just go to facebook.com/WestsideFairyTalesHorrorAndLitClub. You can just search it and you can get there. People are talking about different stuff all the time. Movies, video games, books, anything horror related or even mildly horror related, or anything literature related at all. It doesn't matter what kind of books you want to talk about. If you want to talk books, come and talk about them with us. You can talk about the podcast too at large. You can make fun of me if you think my recommendations were stupid. If you think I didn't make a point, if you want to make your own point about what I was talking about, just hop on in and talk to us. If you wanted to follow me on Twitter, or Instagram, I'm at WS Fairy Tales on Twitter, on Instagram, Westside Fairy Tales on Facebook too. You can always shoot me a line whenever you want at westsidefairytales@gmail.com. If you love the podcast, if you want to support us, please go to westsidefairytales.com/merch, buy a shirt, buy a sticker, buy a poster, buy a mug. We got all kinds of branded stuff there. And if you just want to give me money straight up and join our Patreon for just $1, you get early access to episodes like this and regular episodes on the main feed. For $5, you get a whole lot more. $5, you get a ton of shit. You get the PDF of the monthly story for that now. You get early access to everything. Like on the lower tiers, you also get access to the behind the story video or audio. I say video every time. There is no video anymore. There's videos twice, and then I was just like, I don't want to do a video anymore. Because it's easier to put it out on the RSS feed, and you don't get videos on the RSS that you can get on Patreon. If you get on Patreon, you get your own personalized RSS feed from the Patreon site that will give you access to all this stuff on your regular podcatcher. So you can just not even have to worry about it. You just plug it in, you'll start hearing all this stuff a little bit earlier. If you get up to $10, you get to hear raw versions of the show up to 2 weeks early. And at $20 and more, you get like super big merch packs. You get a signed poster from me, $50. I'll print up any story that you like that I've written. I'll sign it and I'll send it out to you. That's pretty much it. So until next time, as always, stay safe out there. West Side Fairy Tales is written, read, scored, and produced by Tyler Bell. Artwork by Yui Breedlove. The West Side Fairy Tales Horror and Lit Club logo, trademark 2019, as is all content herein. Copyright Tyler Bell.
Something's not quite right in the quiet mountain town of Targrady, West Virginia. Months after a local teen was lynched in the dead of a hot summer night, two men stand charged with murder in what the majority opinion considers to be an open and shut case. But Adelaide Stevenson, a young crime reporter from Charleston, is finding out the smallest cracks in the official narrative run far, far deeper than she could have ever expected. Join Adelaide in West by God as she navigates small-town secrets, the dubious ethics of her own profession, and the dark whispers of an ancient creature, known to some as the Witching Woman, who prowls the shadowed hollers that lie between night and nightmare. Sent on overnight assignment to cover the start of the trial, Adelaide quickly realizes the story she's been told, and been telling, doesn't make sense. Cryptic assertions of a concrete alibi are emailed to her by the family of the accused. Nobody in town seems comfortable discussing the basic facts of the case, and the murder she's been writing about wasn't the only tragic death this summer. Adelaide extends her stay against the wishes of her editor, and her investigations take a complicated and dangerous turn as she discovers the true depths of the mysteries surrounding Targrady. The only real evidence from the night of the murder may lie in the hands of a notorious local crime family led by an enigmatic woman known as the Fetid Queen. Local authorities seem to grow more hostile by the hour, and even Adelaide's own career might not survive this assignment. Featuring an eclectic cast of characters ranging from violent and horrifying to outlandish and fabulous, West by God is a must-read novel for anybody who enjoys Twin Peaks, Stephen King, and all the creepy places you find just off the path in the woods. It is the debut novel of Tyler Bell, a USMC infantry combat veteran, former crime and courts reporter for the Charleston Daily Mail, and creator of the award-winning West Side Fairy Tales horror and dark fiction podcast. Due for release by Henlo Press in October of 2023. Learn more at westsidefairytales.com/westbygod.